about a bunch of guys and women who are inspired by the Bible. In the 1640s, they were inspired by the Bible to chop off the head of the King of England. In 1649, St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlord, they defied the law. They were the dispossessed, we're claiming what was theirs. Come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the waste ground grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it shall be a common treasury for all. The sin of property, we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. Right, the man murder, they took the land. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They made the laws, should chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feels the rich while poor folks starve. We work, we eat together, we need no sword. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the Lord. Still we are free, though we are poor. Diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. Yeah. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and traverse to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages and destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. In peace, the orders came to cut them down. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down. Amanda Palmer, ladies and gentlemen. The world turned upside down. Leon Russellson wrote that. We had a great time here at the Pace Party. Hope you have. Listen, did anybody film that? Because it was great.
I have one for you.
Oh,
yeah? How much time do we have?
And welcome to Here We Stand. This is Kevin Allen at Eagle Strong Voice. It's October 10th. The world turned upside down, and that's going out especially to our indigenous allies this week that have started occupying Church of Rome buildings on the west coast of Canada, taking back the land, holding it in common, as their indigenous vision teaches us, as our own indigenous roots in Europe taught us for many years until they were wiped out by the same force today that we're going to be talking about, because we are breaking some very important news. It's actually coming out tomorrow, and a special announcement. We're going to talk about it here today on Here We Stand, and the announcement is coming from the Tribunal, International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, set up, of course, in 2010, set up the common law courts that put Queen Elizabeth, Pope Benedict on trial, forced Benedict and three cardinals out of office. The ICCCS is now forming its own grand jury to look into the complicity of so-called King Charles, Charles III. We're going to talk about his predecessor who lost his head, Charles I, in a little bit. And that tribunal is going to look into his complicity in the death of the 10 Kamloops children, William Coombs, who was the witness to their murder, and the death of other Indigenous people in Canada, including the very first time Charles came to Canada in 1970. We're going to get into the details of that. It's a preview of what you're going to see tomorrow on the world broadcast of this announcement. But it's very important to keep in mind that this is part of our whole ongoing movement. When you confront the corporatocracy and its criminal organization all over the planet, you invariably come across church, state, monarchy. The notion that one person or a group of people can rule over others, we're putting that to death, folks, by, in part, exposing their crimes and showing how we can fight back under our own sovereignty. The sovereignty of the Common Law Republic movement that now spans 12 countries, part of a Republic Alliance we meet every Saturday online. And these are people in many countries organizing the resistance, setting up the alternative outside the corporate genocidal system, Common Law Republics. Now, as part of that, of course, the Republic of Canada has been active in Canada since January 2015. And we are sponsoring this movement because this is the only way we can fight back. You can't operate in their jurisdiction. And we're demonstrating that today by talking about this new grand jury investigation of Charles Mountbatten Windsor and his connections to these crimes. You can follow our work here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, at bbsradio.com/herewestand, and of course our work, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates, and republicofcanada.org. Check under breaking news and all the other good links there. So I'm going to read to you, first of all, some of the information that will be coming out tomorrow. It's breaking evidence from insiders who have come to our grand jury with information. Perhaps the inauguration of Charles encouraged these people to come forward. I know in the case of Canada, that definitely is what happened. Tomorrow is the 58th anniversary of the permanent disappearance of 10 children from the Kamloops Indian Residential School. But now a group of eyewitnesses have come forward, a new group. They presented their affidavits to our special tribunal, the grand jury that is going to be convening November 1st of this year. And that tribunal is convened to investigate Charles's complicity, not only in the abduction of those 10 children and the death of other kids, but the medical murder of eyewitness William Coombs at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, February 26, 2011. Now let me read some of the announcement that came out through the tribunal's public information office. Quote, "Our tribunal has today received sworn statements from British and Canadian nationals. They claim to have witnessed the personal participation of Charles Mountbatten Windsor, a.k.a. King Charles III, in ceremonies involving native children that occurred in Carnarvon Castle in North Wales and at the former Catholic Indian School in Fort Providence, Northwest Territories in Canada, on October 30, 1964, and on July 11, 1970, respectively. Now, the first ceremony involved the ritual killing of two children. Now, let me explain about that. The 10 children were there abducted, according to a British security officer who was present, who saw Philip and Elizabeth take part in a ritual killing of those children that occurred on, 58 years ago today, October 10th. Two of those children did not die. They were abducted and taken back to England. They were taken to Carnarvon Castle and held there, and then 20 days later, on October 30th, 1964, they were ritually killed. Now, October 30th, as you know, hopefully, is Samhain. It's originally a Celtic New Year date, but it's now a high point in the satanic ritual killing calendar. October 30th, 1964, Cecilia Arnold, age 10, and Edward Arnous, age 10, were ceremonially killed in that location, according to these sources. Second ceremony that Charles took part in was a similar ritual killing of an undetermined number of Inuit children in Northwest Territories, Fort Providence, at a former Catholic residential school like Kamloops, the Sacred Heart Indian School. Now, another witness, a former government employee, claims that the then Prince Charles, in 2011, had personal knowledge of and sanctioned a kill order against William Coombs that was issued by the British MI6 Foreign Intel Agency. William was the sole living eyewitness to these 1964 abductions at Kamloops, where he was interned as a prisoner there. William subsequently died of arsenic poisoning administered to him in St. Paul's Catholic Hospital, February 26, 2011. Now, that was witnessed by our witness, nurse Chloe Kirker, whose statement is online. You're going to see all of this on the posting tomorrow at YouTube and also at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. Now, this new evidence and a lot of the accompanying documentation is being entered into the docket of our tribunal. It'll be presented at the opening session Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. Charles Mountbatten Windsor has been issued a public summons to appear before the tribunal. If he doesn't respond and doesn't appear, it's what's called a de facto admission of guilt. It's what found his mother guilty. It's also what found his predecessor, King Charles I, guilty in 1649 when he refused to respond to charges brought against him by Parliament that he engaged in a legal war against the people, the English Civil War that he had started to depose the power of Parliament and impose tyranny on his people. By not confessing, by not issuing a plea, you're admitting to guilt and are found guilty automatically under common law. In essence, you're not challenging what's being said about you. Now, all of that is going to be posted again tomorrow, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates. But I wanted to make, before we go on in the show, and talk a little bit about the precedent for putting a king on trial, how King Charles, Charlie Boy's predecessor, was lawfully executed by Parliament, and how the monarchy was disestablished on March 17th, 1649, permanently, forever. Monarchy in England and everywhere in the Commonwealth was disestablished lawfully. It was illegally reestablished by Charles's son, but it has not been any kind of de jure legitimate power since its deposing in 1649 by the people in Parliament. So that's important to keep in mind because we have the precedent for doing this. That's why the British monarchy is lawfully disestablished and why these republics are forming all over the British Commonwealth, standing on our tradition and our lawful precedents. But let me comment first about William, because he was a friend of mine. I knew him for 6 years. He was an interior Salish man who was tortured horribly as a child. Electric cattle prods, anal rape, experimental methods used on him. He's also put among children dying of TB when he tried running away. All of that, I got to know him in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and he came on protest with us. He was a good friend. And 10 days before he was murdered by royal decree, William Coombs met me at the Ovaltine Cafe on Hastings Street in Vancouver. Now, he was happier than normal because we had just held another church occupation, which also always lifted all of our spirits. And in the glow of that victory, William had given up drinking that week. And it was quite something because he needed to stay drunk to overcome that horrible pain, the memories of his torture. They even held him on a rack in the basement of the Kamloops School. He was on the burial detail where he had to take children out and bury them. And with a shy smile, before he left, he handed me some poems he had written. And we've got these poems collected. We're going to publish them, six of his poems, handwritten poems from William Coombs that we're going to publish on our websites. But here's what one of the poems read in part. He wrote, "Truth can't be written on dead hearts and minds that think they know. The whites all talk of hearing, but they're sicker than they know. I still remember what they'll never let themselves see. Res school babies crying all night, saying, 'Billy, I'm hungry, please feed me.' So Georgie and me, we hunted for food. We raided the orchards at midnight. Then I froze. I saw figures and a strange light, priests bending over a hole. 'Georgie, who are they?' 'Shh,' he said. 'They're burying another one. Be quiet or we'll be dead too.' I still have nightmares. The screams of the babies never leave. And the ones in the ground saying, 'Billy, Billy, set me free.' Those dreams and those faces I still can see. For the murder at the Kamloops Residential School, I will tell it all. I saw, I saw, I saw." After I read William's poems, he asked me to hold on to them for him. Maybe he had a premonition of some kind. We shook hands and we didn't say goodbye because we expected to rendezvous that same month in London, England, because we had paid William's way to come to our tribunal and speak about what he saw Queen Elizabeth do in Kamloops on October 10th, 1964. But the crown struck first because 10 days later, William Arnold Coombs was dead from arsenic poisoning. Well, the ones who killed my friend think that enough assassinations and midnight burials and official lies can rewrite history and swab out memory. But fortunately, the truth isn't controlled by anybody because it comes from elsewhere. It has a life and a force of its own, and that truth eventually wears down time and crime. And so now even the enormous lie the Crown and the Church have built around their Christian death camps in Canada, it's crumbling. And today, it's collapsing even more. William Coombs has come alive again. He's pointing his accusing finger at the killers, and he's doing that through living eyewitnesses who have come forward to tell our tribunal more about who killed William and those 10 children in Kamloops and those two at Carnarvon Castle and many tens of thousands of other innocents and those who are still dying today from the hideous Ninth Circle. And that finger he is pointing now directly at Charles Mountbatten Windsor, the so-called King of England. Well, here's a summary of some of the details of what we know. We know that on Saturday, October 10th, 1964, in the hills above Dead Man's Creek, 40 miles west of Kamloops, 8 of the 10 children who were abducted by Elizabeth and Philip Mountbatten Windsor were brutally and ritually killed. We know that from a retired British security officer who said that they were both present at that ritual. As we've described, two of those children were kept alive, brought to England, to Carnarvon Castle in North Wales, built by the Romans, and has been named by many other eyewitnesses, including Toos Nieuwenhuis and Anne-Marie van Beenborg, who were taken there as children. That was a satanic sacrificial center for many centuries, and now used by the Ninth Circle Vatican Network. These two children, Cecilia Arnold was an interior Salish girl from Kamloops. Edward Arnous was a Métis boy from Quesnel, B.C. They were both 10. And then, after 10 days being held there, 20 days, they were ritually raped, tortured, killed, and cannibalistically devoured, as is the part of the cult that goes back to Roman times. And Philip Mountbatten Windsor was there with his eldest son, Charles, who we now call the King of England, because Charles was inducted into the Ninth Circle cult that night. Well, fast forward to July 1st, 1969, Charles returns to Carnarvon Castle, this time to be invested as Prince of Wales. It happened on exactly the same location, Carnarvon Castle, July 1st, 69. Exactly 1 year later to the day, on July 1st, 1970, Charles Mountbatten Windsor begins his first official visit to Canada, along with his sister Anne and his parents, Elizabeth and Philip. Guess where they were heading? After the obligatory ceremony in Ottawa, they head to rural Aboriginal communities in Manitoba and Fort Providence in the Northwest Territories. And there, at another Catholic residential school called Sacred Heart, Inuit children died at the hands of the Mountbatten Windsors and their Vatican accomplices. Well, in that ocean of blood, deceptively camouflaged under the name Indian residential schools, child murder was the norm. And so these killings stayed cloaked in the usual secrecy and terror. The same kind of secrecy that's still going on where they announced that, oh, there weren't that many children who died. We don't know if there were mass graves. A continual rewriting and swabbing out of memory by the killers. But that doesn't always work, because years later, the sole surviving eyewitness came forward. But by doing that, when William spoke about what he saw, he spoke at our rallies about it, he spoke on my former radio show, Hidden from History, about it. And because of that, when he was about to come to England to talk about it, he was ordered to be killed by a royal decree. And that decree was enacted through the British Foreign Intelligence Agency, MI6, and its counterparts in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Canada, specifically by the West Coast E Division of the RCMP, under the authority of its Black Ops Coordinator, Inspector Peter Montague. Montague, who organized the smear campaign against yours truly, against our campaign to expose the residential school crimes, and against anybody who challenges so-called Crown authority. Montague was behind his killing. On February 19th, 2011, William was forcibly abducted from his East Pender Street slum hotel by three Mounties and brought to the Catholic St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. William's nurse, Chloe Kirker, states on record that he was in good health. He had no symptoms of his official cause of death later, which was tubercular meningitis. And having seen William, I can confirm that. He had no signs of TB. He was off drinking. He was improving in health. But 4 days later, by February 23rd, he developed what are called Mies lines on his fingernails. They're horizontal lines, and they indicate arsenic poisoning. And yet, Chloe Kirker, the nurse, was ordered by St. Paul's administrators not to have William on an IV and to keep him dehydrated. Well, in hindsight, that was to allow the poison in his system to disseminate quickly and fatally. And after William died, Chloe Kirker was threatened not to speak about it. And when she did, she was threatened, continually harassed, death threats issued, forced her to quit her job, and she moved out of the country. Well, the plot thickens. The Vancouver coroner, Claire Thompson, took nearly 4 months to issue a report on the death of William Coombs. On June 13, 2011, Ms. Thompson stated on record that William Coombs died of, quote, disseminated tuberculosis, even though William had no evidence of TB in his system, and he had a strong indication of arsenic poisoning. Ms. Thompson refused to answer all inquiries about William's death, and the Vancouver coroner's office threatened to sue anyone who publicly challenged her report. She's still in that position. She's the coordinator of the Vancouver Metro Regional Coroner's Office. I urge you all to call Claire Thompson, the coroner who whitewashed William Coombs' death. Her number is 604-660-7708. That's Claire Thompson, Vancouver coroner, 604-660-7708. You can also look up her email. Well, finally, and this makes even more connections, the same week that William died, I was invited in writing by Mohawk elders in Brantford, Ontario, to come and investigate the mass grave of children at another Church of England school, the so-called Mushhole. The same Mushhole school where British and Dutch royal family members routinely abducted Aboriginal children for over a century, and we have them from many sources, including in the church. Well, a church insider had a lot of evidence of those abductions, including the ritual killings of children at the Mushhole. Her name was Leona Moses, and I spoke to her, along with Cheryl Squire, on one occasion. Leona, however, was officially silenced by Anglican Archbishop Fred Hiltz in Toronto after I showed up at Brantford in the spring of 2011, soon after William died. Hiltz acted under the direct instructions of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who was later convicted on our common law court of participation in these crimes against humanity. Then, soon after that, Leona and her incriminating evidence are all destroyed in a house fire. She dies, along with the pathologist who looked at the bones and said, yes, they were human, Don Ordner. He also died. After I came to Brantford, this all began to come out, and we began to do a dig there at the Mushhole mass gravesite and, as I said, discovered child's bones. Well, the final piece of that, of course, or for now the final piece, is that just prior to that, I'd been in England awaiting William to arrive at our tribunal. And while I was there, I'd gotten into some of the church archives, the Mushhole archives. The day I did that, I was notified to report to the authorities. I was summarily arrested and deported from England on May 26, 2011, 3 months to the day that William Coombs had been murdered at St. Paul's Hospital by MI6 and the RCMP and the Catholic and Anglican churches. Well, all of this proves again the murderous and criminal nature of what we're dealing with, the British Crown and its Vatican accomplice in genocide. You know, for many years we've exposed and proved that their crime in courts of law, our own courts of law, because the Crown courts consistently refuse to even allow this into court. And it's through the suffering and blood of eyewitnesses like William Coombs that this is continuing. Those criminals are still in charge, and they've absolved themselves of the crime and erased their atrocities, and now they're even erasing the erasure that's been going on for the last 5 years or more. And so their genocide is continuing. But this has been our answer to all of this atrocity. We've learned there's no possibility of justice in their system, which is why we've created our own inquiries, our own courts of law outside their jurisdiction. Our present tribunal that's putting King Charles on trial is a continuation of that struggle. And like I say, it goes back to 1649 when the first King Charles was put on trial for the same treason and terror against his people. But we're also arming ourselves with the means to enforce the verdict of this latest trial. We are enforcing it by building our own common law republics outside Crown jurisdiction that can fight and overcome these crimes against humanity, which are now aimed at all of us. Because we're engaged in a war to the death against tyranny and mass murder. And the first step in resisting those evils is to collectively declare our independence from their genocidal system in London, in Rome, in Beijing, wherever it is. We do that, and I'm going to talk about this in the second half of the show after a short break. We do this by setting up our own local assemblies and taking three basic steps in declaring independence. And we're going to talk about that after the break. But I want to, before we hear these voices of William and other witnesses at the break, I want to remind everyone to remember that if we refuse to honor and learn from all our fallen heroes, people like William Coombs, we not only dishonor their sacrifice for us, we ensure our own destruction. Remember always these fallen brothers and sisters, and carry on. Otherwise, the darkness is going to hold final sway over all of us. So you can follow murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates tomorrow. This general announcement's going out all over the world. Please post it everywhere, because it's interesting. If you notice in the corporate media, they're addressing this. They're actually issuing the standard denials that Queen Elizabeth ever abducted 10 children, and they died. That is an amazing breakthrough, because usually they put a cloak of silence and secrecy over all of this. Now they feel it's necessary to respond with their own lies to try to cover this up. It shows that we're hitting a nerve. So keep pressing on this nerve. Now, to put the human face on all this, we're going to listen now to about 5 minutes of the words and testimonies of eyewitnesses to these crimes, including at the mush hole, and also William Coombs' voice talking about what he witnessed. We'll be back after that.
I'm in favor. I'm 75. I went to residence school in Muskogee in 1941 to 1949. And I had a very, very rough life. I was mistreated in every way. As a young girl, she was 7 years old. She was pregnant. And what they did, she had her baby. They took the baby, wrapped it up in a nice pink outfit, took it downstairs. I was in the kitchen with the nun for cooking supper. They took the baby into the where they make a fire and all that to heat up the school, furnace room. They threw that little baby in there and burnt it alive. All you could hear was, that was it. And you could smell the flesh cooking. It's a big mistake when people say we were treated good. No way.
So after my brother got better, he needed to go back to the mush hole. And we didn't go back for that next year. But it was some time after that, during the time that that we were out of school for the summer, that he had, and we were going to go back. And he said, you know what happened to all of those kids that were there at the mush hole? He said, do you remember that? And I said, yeah. I said, our dorm was just full of girls. And he said, yeah, so was ours full of boys. And he said, do you know what happened to them? And I said, no. And he said, they called in the army and they took them to the army base and they shot them. They stood them all along this big hole and they shot them, and it was as when the bullets hit them, they fell into the hole. And he said, when they were all done, he said, those that hadn't fallen into the hole, some of them were still alive. He said, some of them were still alive in the hole. And he said, they came along. And I want to say a bulldozer. That what comes to my mind, but I'm not really sure that my brother had said a bulldozer. They came along with a big machine anyway, and they shoved them all in that big hole and they covered it up. And he says, that's what happened to them. And I must have been about 8, I guess, or 7 or 8, somewhere through there. Let's see, that must have been 43 or 44.
Furnace going burning 24/7, which was totally out of bounds, and me and a friend witnessed two of the sisters or brothers taking looked like little bodies under white wrappings or white cloth, and putting into the furnace. And the Queen came and visited. For about 3 days, three days, I don't know how long it was, I think it was about 3 days actually, and a lot of children went missing there. many children that weren't cooperative, and like myself, wasn't cooperative, and they were put into with the children who were sick with at the end of the dormitory. They kept the sickies there, the ones who were sick with tuberculosis, and they put me and my brother Ernie in with the ones who were sick because we wouldn't comply.
In the same room with people who had TB, they didn't separate us.
Then we were forced to play with them. The nuns made us play with those kids. We didn't want to get sick either, but they were forcing us to play with those kids. And also, they made some of them sleep with the other kids.
I would have loved to have seen the perpetrators severely punished for all of this. And I would, the greatest thing I would want to see is the Church of England get barred from practicing in Canada.
It's just insane. Like, you don't murder children and get away with it. And I work every day to protect children, and it just really bothers me that so many of our children have been killed. And nothing's ever been done about it. Like, you read about it, and there's information on it all over the place, but nothing's ever been done about it. So why should these people, the churches and the government and Indian Affairs, we're all in on this as well, why should they get away with killing our children? It's just not right, and something needs to be done about it.
Voices of a Canadian Genocide, Canadian Holocaust. Irene Favell, Lorna McNaughton, William Coombs, Cheryl Squire. You know, what can you say, right? I've heard so many of these stories over the years and seen the evidence of it and held the bones that you realize after a while that the crime is so historic, so ongoing, so enormous that I found this working with people that you reach a certain psychic numbness after a while. You shut it out. And that, of course, allows it to continue. That is our enemy's greatest weapon, our unwillingness to not only look at it, but do something about it. We've proven you can do something about it. These beasts in power have a lot less power than we realize. 90% of it is through ignorance and fear. And so we counter the ignorance and fear through action and through knowledge. And what I want to do now is share two things. The precedents that allow us to put a king on trial, but also the human face of this genocide and my knowledge of William Coombs and his soul story. That I'm going to read a few excerpts from my book, Fallen, The Story of the Vancouver Four. You can get all of this. Go to murderbydecree.com. And look under, on the main page, you see how to order these books. You can get it on Amazon as well. Fallen, the Story of the Vancouver Four, that is William Coombs, Ricky LaVallee, Bingo Dawson, and Harry Wilson, all of them active in our movement, all of them murdered. And, on the streets of Vancouver and elsewhere. The other thing I want to draw your attention to is two really important books by the same guy, and it's a very important source. His name's Jeffrey Robertson. He's an English lawyer. He wrote a book called The Case of the Pope, showing that the Pope can and should be put on trial. He's not a head of state. And he outlines in great detail the crimes of the Vatican, really used it as a source for my book, Dethroning a Rogue Power, Why the Vatican Must Be Denied Membership and Presence at the United Nations and in the World Community. That book is now circulating all over the UN delegations, and there is a move afoot at the UN to expel the Vatican from the General Assembly based on its crimes, its illegal condition being in there in the UN in the first place. And so it shows you action can happen combined with knowledge and determination, a refusal to ever give up. When you hear about children being burned in furnaces and being shot on the edge of a ditch in 1944 by Canadian troops near Brantford, Ontario, you know the nature of what we're in. It may camouflage its appearance. And now that it's biting all of us through these police state measures, that may have slackened for a little bit, but the beast itself is not dying. It's not going away. Now that it's happened to all of us, you know what we're facing. So the other book that Jeffrey Robertson wrote, which I'm going to quote today, is called The Tyrannicide Brief, The Story of the Men Who Put Charles I on Trial. And it's really all the legal and historic arguments showing that it's perfectly lawful and necessary to put monarchs on trial because they don't have any basis for being in power in the first place, especially in the case of England, where the monarchy was lawfully disestablished on March 1649 by Parliament after the English Civil War. But one of the things going to talk about that first, then I'll go to my book, Fallen, and the Memories of William, which is the most poignant. If you look through this book, you'll find some really important points in here, and it was really the basis of our common law court trial that put Benedict and Queen Elizabeth on trial, forced some of them out of office. Some basic principles that were established during the English Revolution, that is, first of all, they ended all immunity from prosecution of monarchs. That is, the old saying in English common law, be you ever so high, you are not above the law, even if you be king or pope. As a man, as a woman, you can be tried for your actions. Maybe not in the rules of their club, but in the higher law of international law, the law of nature, common law, yes, everyone has unlimited liability for their actions. So that's the first point. Secondly, they named this thing called the crime of tyranny, that anyone in what's called a command responsibility, king, president, pope, anyone who commands others is responsible for all of the deeds of those other people. They call it vicarious liability in common law. But it means that if you're a head of state or church or whatever, you have command responsibility and can be held responsible for the crime of tyranny, of killing your own citizens, like the monarchs have done, like Charles did, like Elizabeth did, like Bergoglio has done through the Ninth Circle. And we have the basis then to put them on trial as individuals. Also, those trials can establish a new political regime. That's what happened in England. They put the king on trial, and they had to set up a republic after, because there was no more monarch, no more head of state. That's exactly what we did. History repeating itself. January 15th, 2015, in Winnipeg, 212 of us came together and said there's no longer a head of state in Canada. The Queen of England, Elizabeth Windsor, is a convicted felon. There is no lawful authority in Canada anymore. We need to create it. And 54% of Canadians agree with us. They want a republic. They want all ties to the crown. So, again, history keeps repeating itself in these cycles. And it's funny that Charles III is now in the position that Charles I was, facing a people who are able lawfully to depose him, as we've already deposed in general the British monarchy through our lawful actions. Now, also, there's a law that was passed in Parliament at the time, which is held all through common law, even after the restoration of the monarchy, the unlawful and restoration of the monarchy. It said a monarch cannot challenge a court set up by the commons, even a court set up to judge the monarch. That's a principle. That's the basis on which our common law courts were set up. And, you know, it just goes on and on like that. This book is very important to study. As a matter of fact, what we're going to do within the Republic movement in this Republic Alliance that I mentioned, now operating in 12 countries, write to us, republicnationalcouncil@protonmail.com, if you want to be part of that. And one of the things we're doing on that is educating ourselves about this history. We're going to be doing a series, two subjects coming up, which I'm helping organize. The first in our, really their citizenship schools, how to be educated and raised in a new way of thinking, a new republic, setting up new schools for our children outside the criminal jurisdictions of the status quo. And one of the things we do in these citizenship schools is teach our true history, things like the English Revolution, the deposing of the British monarchy, the lawful right to establish our own sovereign republics. And so we're going to be looking at that, the contents of this book, in an upcoming online educational. We're also going to be looking at basic principles of how to set up these republics. And as I mentioned earlier, here's what you can do right now, wherever you're living, anywhere in the world, but especially in what's called the British Commonwealth. Gather 12 or more people together, because then you're a lawful body, like a jury. But laws can then be passed by you, as we did in Canada, when we abolished all COVID measures on September 20th, 2020, and we nullified federal taxes. We stopped paying taxes to the federal government as a genocide organization that was aiding and abetting Vatican crimes. So those 12 people constitute not only a lawful jury, they also constitute a lawful legislative body that can pass and enforce their own laws with their own sheriffs. Now, you gather the 12 together and you do three things. First of all, you declare independence from the British Crown and you revoke all allegiance to it. We have the wording of that Declaration of Independence. And again, write to us, Republic National Council at protonmail.com. We'll send your copy. So first step, declare independence and revoke allegiance to the existing authority and the Crown. Secondly, you pass your own laws to establish the Republic sovereignty in your own community. In effect, you're replacing the town council, who will all take an oath of allegiance to the British monarch illegally. Some of the laws you can pass to establish your own republic sovereignty is, like I say, you nullify all taxes to the federal government. You pass your own laws in your own community, the things you, the people, want. You pass them in your assembly, and they have lawful authority. We know that because whenever we show our laws to the police, they back off. Every single time. I remember when we began occupying churches in Vancouver, like I mentioned earlier in that reminiscence about William Coombs, I remember one of the times the police showed up, and I showed them the right of entry that had been given to me by Chief Capilano, the Squamish elder in Vancouver, who filed in the BC Supreme Court. Even in their system, he filed his banishment order. He expelled all the churches that had committed genocide from his territory in Vancouver, the Catholic, Anglican, United Churches. And he gave me, as his legal agent, the right of entry into those churches to seize them. Well, ever since he submitted that in court, I would show that document to the police, and they would always back off. That's why we were able to do these church occupations, because we stood on the law. It works. But it only works if you try it, folks. And that's what we're empowering people to do by these workshops and this program and all of our work. Third thing you do, besides passing the law, is you elect delegates to attend a national constitutional convention to set up a national republic. So those three things, declare your independence, revoke allegiance, pass laws in your own community, elect delegates to a national constitutional convention. Those are basic steps in setting up the republic. Now, there's a lot more to say on that. As a matter of fact, next week's show, I'm going to present a more thorough going into of this book, The Tyrannicide Brief, which you should really get. It's like a handbook in how to depose unlawful authorities, just like Sun Tzu, The Art of War is. So, very important book. The thing I want to share, though, is that William Coombs and others, William was like a tip of an iceberg, and he was an extraordinary man. He was, among his own interior Salish people, he was what's called a spirit dancer. And in our traditions, we call them just souls. People who are set apart to do the hard work and who never stop, who carry the pain of humanity and the consciousness of the higher creator in their own flesh and blood and spirit so that they can't stop what they're doing. They fight to the death, unlike many people who haven't attained that spirit yet. And in this book, I look at not only his life, but that of his friends. And let me just read one of the things here. William Coombs was the epitome of a Red School survivor. He was short but powerfully built, which no doubt is how he survived the horrific tortures I began to learn about. His eyes were the kind I'd only seen a few times before in garden variety psychopaths, hard and agate without a drop of feeling. But behind the mask lurked something else. When I met William the second time, he seemed more approachable because the first time he had simply just kind of snarled at me and didn't want to speak. But I noticed a pile of papers in front of him. We met at a place called the Dugout on Powell Street. It's a drop-in center. And he was scrawling on it, and when I tried looking at it, he grabbed the papers and shoved them inside his ripped shirt. "You people are always trying to look into what we're doing," he said, and I gave him time. Eventually, we became friends, and he showed me his poetry. And the poetry he was writing was about a guy called Brother Murphy. Brother Murphy died a few years before I met William. And William described him to me. He said, quote, "The bastard's buried right in the mission school. He's got a really nice headstone." And then he went on to describe how Brother Murphy had killed his brother Ernie by pushing him down a flight of stairs, and how he had been sodomized by Brother Murphy with an electric cattle prod every night for years. And, you know, when you hear those stories, you realize, well, look, how can this coexist along the so-called reality that we know? Well, very simple. It's that whole dissociated consciousness we all live in, where we don't really want to see what's threatening us, even though it is, and what's killed off our brothers and sisters. This book really describes how Billy and others opened my eyes to this reality, because my own life was being destroyed, and I think that's the combination you need. People who've lost their options have to fight, and they have to change their minds. If you haven't lost your options, you've got a toehold of security in the system, you don't want to change. We're all like that. We have to be forced to change, and then our mind can be opened. That's been my experience. I also want to share something in this book that was kind of poignant. It's after May, his partner, told me about how he had died. Billy Coombs had a relationship with a woman who worked on the street. Her name was May. She used to come on the show and, you know, talk about everything going on in their life. And May met me after, and I described this in the book. I'd been out of town, she said to me. I couldn't hang around after what they did to William. I talked to the nurse that was with him, and they said they gave him a shot just before he died. Two guys in suits gave the order. She'd never seen him before. They put him into a coma. They killed him. Well, when she said that, she emitted a shriek and made heads turn in the restaurant we had met in. And later she began to go into more detail about something that eventually led me to that nurse, Chloe Kirker, who was the eyewitness to the fact that, yes, they had injected him with stuff that had killed him, arsenic poisoning. So what really I find ironic is that after William died, he suddenly became a celebrity, and you see this all over the place. Everyone now in the all over the world, you hear talk about William Coombs. And what I wrote about that was that it's kind of hard at the moment, folks, because this is real. But let me gather myself here for a minute. Billy was somebody who they normally people even wouldn't even look at twice. And it's the same people who now seem to show great interest in him, wouldn't have given them the time of day if they had met him on the street. And I remember I got a call from a young woman at the University of BC. She was doing her graduate degree, and she wanted to interview me about to prove that William had been killed of foul play. And I remember I said to her, well, if you prove that he died like that, you might end up like he did. Of course, the young girl was white and a student, and she'd never suffer such an end, even if she wrenched a confession out of the doctor who finished off Bill. Up-and-coming white professionals never need to get whacked to shut them up. A few harsh words from the right department normally suffices. But of course, she didn't know any of that, and my words shut her down pretty quick. A few years ago, I would have probably indulged her illusions. The pastor in me used to encourage people in their false hopes and illusions, because that way I wouldn't have to give up any of my own. But once my own assurances were smashed to bits, the old hand-holding habit became more than redundant. Anyway, academics on the prowl are worse than a crack addict, since they assume they don't have to pay for anything. But she wasn't the only one. Occasionally, a horde of activist groupies would descend on the downtown east side in search of the real story behind William Coombs' death. Despite the mounting fear attached to my name from the smear campaign, I was one of the oldest fixtures in the downtown east side by then, and by surreptitious routes, a few adventurous weekend radicals would sometimes seek me out, and they always spoke of William Coombs. And this is percolated finally into the internet. And that's why I'm telling you the real story here, so the distortion can be minimized. I couldn't figure out at first why Billy had become such a celebrity among people who normally didn't care about him. If not his real person, then at least the idea of Billy Coombs had caught hold among trendy politicos who had no doubt heard about his fate from one of my broadcasts or articles. They all wanted to cash in on his image as a martyred Native warrior. After all, Natives are sexier than a white person. So he was the natural flavor of the month. But soon it was obvious that it was Bill's status as a witness to a felony by the Queen of England that made him popular. Like a National Enquirer headline, William Coombs attained overnight an imagined and celebratory status he never could have in life as a valiant Native warrior who'd spoken the truth about Lizzie Britt's abduction of children and then paid the ultimate price for it. Pasting together imaginary Indians is an age-old Canadian pastime, and it's never gone out of vogue, especially in these noxious days of backpatting reconciliation. The old habit dies hard. Centuries ago, when my own Highlander ancestors got wiped out or deported from our land by the British, the latter invented a modified kilt that became all the rage around London for a time as a souvenir of their latest conquest. And William Coombs became like that. He was stereotyped out of existence by the very culture that wiped him out and then pretended it never happened. Maybe all the young white kids who idolize Bill's image from a distance need to do so to distract themselves from what's in the mirror. Of course, in truth, Billy would laugh about it all and not give a shit. While he lived, he just wanted to forget about the day at Dead Man's Creek and find a metal sanctuary from his nightmares. My outrage at what the herd does to his memory is just my own imagining of my friend, who may have not been one at all. The chimeras cling to all of us dearly. And meanwhile, our group possession continues. Well, that's from my book, Fallen. And in the next few minutes, I want to just share kind of a secret. People saying, well, how come you haven't been killed, Kev? Well, I have been. My whole life was destroyed. Everything short of physically killing me has happened to me, and it changed me. And once it changes you, you get a light and protection around you that they find more difficult to break through. That's part of it. But don't forget, the system needs to keep somebody like me alive because we scare people off. We say, look, look what we did to Kevin Annett. Look at how ostracized and isolated he is now. Look what he did to his family and his kids and everything. And he's a white guy. Imagine what we can do to you as an Indian if you open your mouth. So in a way, the system uses us. They also monitor what I've discovered, like I just announced today about the new evidence proving Charles Windsor's complicity in these crimes. That's going to come out on November 1st in more detail. They need people like me digging into that because that way they can monitor it. They say, okay, we didn't know that. Now let's move on that and shut it down. So in a way, ironically, there's a weird dialectic going on. We are actually creating our own downfall by everything we do because we're handing the opposition the ammunition they need to shoot us with. But it works two ways because they continually give us ammunition with which to bring them down. That's why reading Sun Tzu is so important. There's this beautiful dance that goes on. Once you see that you and your adversary are actually not opposites, you're part of the same process, the same mystery that goes on. And you have to learn to think and act like a warrior. And the habits of war are not the same as habits of peacetime. And that's why most of us who haven't been through these wars and these learnings and these deaths haven't acquired the skills yet. And it's strange because speaking on all these calls, like the Republic Alliance call and these other online meetings and face-to-face with people when I'm able to, you find that kind of blank stare. People don't quite understand what they don't really understand at all what I'm talking about. But I learned that our job is not to go down to the level of the herd, if you like. Our job is to bring up to our level of understanding and commitment and awareness those who will be brought. It's called orienting to the remnant. Sun Tzu talks about that in The Art of War. He says, veterans win battles. The majority of the soldiers do not. They are led by the veterans, by the officers, by the NCOs, the others who have had the battle experience. They fall first, but they lead the others into battle, and those others learn how to fight. And it's like, I like to remind folks of that experience my dad had in the Korean War, where he said the first day in battle, all the soldiers were ducking down because they didn't want to be hit by bullets. But then when some of their friends started dying, they realized they had to fight back. And we all naturally do that. We go for cover. We try to protect ourselves until we realize there's no protection left. And you need to get whacked around. You need to have these experiences of suffering and loss to open your eyes to become a fighter and not an observer. So it's hard to relate to the mass of observers, and that's why I've stopped doing that. This show is designed for folks who are willing to take the next step, engage in battle, go through suffering and loss, become harder and tougher, because what's happened so far, folks, is mild in comparison to what's coming down the pipe. And that is proven by history, which moves in cycles, as we've talked about today. History is repeating itself. We've learned its lessons. We've got to apply them now. And that's what we're doing. That's the purpose on our show. We have only a couple of minutes left, so I want to remind folks that to get involved in any of this, including the campaigns you've heard about internationally and in Canada and elsewhere where we're building the common law republics, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com. I know very few of you ever do, but I put out the call anyway for you to reach out and do more than listen, overcome that atomizing brainwashing you've been through where you're a passive consumer of information. That's not doing anything. Listening and reading stuff is not doing anything. It's a springboard to possible action. And those of you who are able to do that, write Republic National Council at protonmail.com. And also to me individually, angelfire101 at protonmail.com. Read murderbydecree.com. Go there tomorrow to ITCCS updates for this latest announcement, which is going around the world, about the new evidence about Charles Mountbatten Windsor and our move now to depose the latest King Charles, repeating our ancestors' actions about 450 years ago when we brought down another king and led to not only the founding of the English Republic, but the founding of the American Republic, because the seeds of the Puritan and Cromwellian Republic in England were already planted in New England and America, and they formed the basis of really the American Constitution and the Republic, the idea that people didn't need kings, we don't want kings or popes, we want to govern ourselves and our own congregations directly. There is no sovereign but the people with the authority of God, and that is really the lesson that came out of the English Revolution and the American Revolution. In that spirit, we're going to end, and reminding you, republicofcanada.org, and we're going to end on a very nice song. It's kind of one of the theme songs of this show, Farewell to the Crown, which sums it all up, folks, and I hope you will listen in tomorrow and again next week to these educationals we're doing. Until then, stay strong, stay clear, stay active. This is Kevin Anand at Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you.
Around.